Welcome back. Why do young voters, those between the ages of 18 and 25, seem to have so little interest in the political process? Fewer than half of those eligible voted in the last presidential election. Their level of what's called informed engagement is about 10%. It's another way of saying they don't care that they don't care. These are some facts found in a recent report published by CIRCLE, the acronym for the Center for Information and Research on Civic Learning and Engagement, based at Tufts University's Tisch College of Citizenship and Public Service. It's based on a survey of more than 6,000 students and 700-plus educators. Joining me to talk about the report is Kay Kawashima Ginsberg, CIRCLE's Deputy Director. Kay, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
I'd like to just ask you at the outset why you call young people 18 to 25 such a critical and crucial constituency in politics today.
Well, there are several reasons, but one of them is that it is one of the biggest generation. They're called echo boomers for a reason. And also, it's going to be an interesting generation in that they're also the most diverse generation. They represent a lot of different backgrounds, including immigrant background, but about 38% of those young people under 30 are people of color. So there's going to be diverse opinions coming from them, and they also face unique challenge of that generation. Some of them is that, you know, they are facing really confusing and dysfunctional government that they've been watching as emerging adults. Older adults like us have watched some of the bipartisan policymaking and policymakers making compromises for Americans. These people haven't seen that, so it's unique in that sense. They're also just swimming in the sea of information, particularly in the internet, and that can be a challenging time for them because they're learning to be political while they're also getting limited range of information, which can be the case when they're getting information from the internet. And finally, the inequality within that generation is really worse than ever before. The students that go to certain kind of schools are getting a lot more opportunities to learn, not just about the political process, but in other ways, where the students that are going to low-income district schools are getting a much less high-quality education.
Well, the sea of information that you say that they're swimming in apparently is of no interest to them when it comes to things political. What is the term you use? Informed engagement, I guess it is. They just don't seem to care.
Well, you know, I think it's less about whether they care about it or not, but it's about sort of having difficulty consuming information in a critical and careful way. As you probably know, the internet can be such an echo chamber. If you're connecting with friends and exchanging news, which they actually do quite often and express their opinions, they're still doing that with friends who have pretty similar opinions. So they're not likely to actually be exposed to different views, different kinds of news coverage. And so they might not be gaining much from that kind of access.
Well, there are some exceptions to the rule, and while engaging young people in the political process can be a challenge, that hasn't stopped a 12-year-old sixth grader from University City here from writing a weekday newsletter about politics. St. Louis Public Radio and the Beacon's Alex Hoyer shares how this political junkie is on a mission to engage with people of all ages.
Good morning, Brittany Woods. Good morning.
There's nothing unusual about Brittany Woods Middle School on a weekday morning. There are words of encouragement over the intercom and, of course, kids rushing to get to class.
Hurry up and make it. You can make it. If you're in the building, you can make it in 30 seconds. Hurry up. Stop talking.
But then everything quiets down, and at the end of a long hallway, librarian Kelly Werthmuller greets sixth grade student Gabe Fleischer.
Morning, Gabe.
Hey. Dubbed the pint-sized pundit, Fleischer is thin, has shaggy brown hair, and wears braces, which happen to be red, white, and blue. And today he's wearing a custom-made blue t-shirt which reads, Wake Up to Politics, which is also the name of the political newsletter he's been writing since fourth grade. It's clear that this is a routine. He goes to his usual table, unzips his backpack, and pulls out a black laptop. And then he gets to work.
Today I'm writing a lot about Obamacare and healthcare.gov. And what the White House is doing to try to relaunch it. And so there's a lot about that and related topics like the president's going to sign up for insurance.
Fleischer also includes the president and vice president's schedule, a This Day in History item, and a trivia question.
It was the anniversary of the Monroe Doctrine being rolled out, so I asked who was the person that really drafted the doctrine.
And what's the answer?
The answer is John Quincy Adams, who was Secretary of State at the time.
Fleischer wakes up at 6 o'clock on school days to start writing the newsletter from home, and it takes him most of this 40-minute class period in the library to finish. As he continues typing, librarian Kelly Werthmuller sits at her desk about 20 feet away.
I've been subscribed to Wake Up to Politics for 2 years, since he was in fourth grade. During the presidential election, that's where I got all of my political information. So, from a fourth grader.
Werthmuller says Fleischer is engaging and passionate. Most of all, she values the consistency and reliability of his work. Fleischer's mom was the first subscriber, and there are now more than 550, including White House staffers and other employees in the federal government. And while Fleischer thinks it's surreal that he could be informing them, like many Americans, he's disappointed with the way government functions.
Whenever they have 11th-hour deals in these negotiations, they're breaking the system for when my generation is going to be in Washington, and they just set a horrible precedent for future negotiations in the decades to come. And they're really disengaging people of all ages about politics. And to be a good democracy, we need people to be interested and involved.
A national commission based at Tufts University near Boston released a report earlier this year which shows now is a particularly challenging time for civics education because of bitter partisan and ideological conflicts. And that's why Brittany Woods Middle School principal Jamie Jordan says she supports Fleischer's efforts.
What Gabe's doing is really what we should be emulating with all of our kids. You know, that they're actually taking information and knowledge and then putting it together and analyzing it and then bringing it back out into a way that's more effective than just a poster board on, you know, a state rep.
Back at the table in the library, Fleischer is putting the finishing touches on this edition of Wake Up to Politics. And to be fair, politics is not his only interest. His friends say he's not obsessed with it, and he does other activities. He's on student council and plays soccer.
My plan is to be a history professor and maybe also a journalist, but I go back between, like, journalist and history professor, historian, author. So I'm not really sure yet, but I have a lot of time.
But for now, it's time for Spanish class. I'm Alex Hoyer, St. Louis Public Radio and The Beacon.
By the way, we have more information about young Gabe Fleischer on our website at stlpublicradio.org. Now back to our conversation with Kay Kawashima Ginsburg from Tufts University. Kay, what do you think? This man, a young man, seems an exception.
You know, a guy like this really brings a smile to my face. But at the same time, he doesn't have to be unique. He's extraordinary, but good civic and political education can really create kids like this, who are really passionate, cares about politics, and really knows what he's talking about. And we found in our research that, you know, many things matter, and civic and political education is really a shared responsibility, not just by school, but parents, the community, the school district, policymakers, and media. A lot of things matter in that if the students receive really sort of engaging form of civic education, like talking about the topics of the day, and talking about issues where students can disagree seriously, but come to some kind of agreement at the end of the day, or agree to disagree, or doing research about the community that really matters to them, that are relevant about the policy or what happens to their parks or to their schools. Those things are all related to how engaged young adults become as they grow up. Other things matter too, like having friends like Gabe who talks passionately about politics and thinking about getting engaged when they become of age, so to say. Those young adults also are a lot more engaged in our research. Even teachers who don't teach in vacuum, right? They have all these knowledge and things that they want to do, but they need support from the district and from the parents and the community stakeholders to be able to talk about politics and teach about how those systems work and why it's not working now and what kind of contributions the young people can make.
Kay, going back to the idea about the teachers and the role of the teachers, in your report you speak of an inhospitable climate for the teachers themselves. Would you elaborate on that?
Sure. You know, I think teachers actually have a lot of people to report to, not just to their principal, but to the district, but especially parents who really care about what kids are getting in schools. And I think the recent sort of a confusing and hostile climate at the national politics reflect in the school politics as well. So when we ask teachers about how much support they're getting from the parents and the community members, about a quarter of them were either unsure or didn't think that they were getting support to teach about politics in social studies and civics class, believe it or not. And when we asked a little bit more about that in open-ended questions, teachers really recalled some specific instances where, you know, especially in 2008 election, for example, when they were talking about the then candidate Obama and their policies and all of that, enough parents took an issue with that and said that the teachers at school should never talk about politics in classrooms. And, you know, from some of us, that's an outrageous claim because you're trying to give political education to these students. But enough parents are concerned that teaching about issues like that can skew their kids' political views, and then they can be partisan. And that's an ongoing issue with civics education.
Well, it sounds to me like the issue is not with the children not learning. It's with the parents not allowing them to learn. That's where it would seem to me you'd have to start.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, when you talk to teachers and young people, that's kind of the conversation that they remember the most, you know, talking about really difficult political issues and having some heated conversations with their friends and teachers and getting really excited about how much those policies actually matter. So it's a shame and that, you know, some teachers really feel like they can't do that anymore.
Only exacerbated, I'm sure, by the whole political climate in this country today, the polarization and the shrill tone of the debate.
That's absolutely right. So the parents are sometimes divided within the school district or school's population. So if the, you know, parents believe that the certain teachers have a specific kind of political belief, they're likely to be even more defensive. Another thing that's difficult and challenging is that the schools are becoming increasingly divided in that some of the schools that have more resources and have less pressure of testing and meeting some of the standards have a lot more freedom to explore issues that are not going to be in a test necessarily. Whereas the low-resource schools, that would be poor urban public school districts usually, they tend to have enormous pressure to just cover the facts, and they don't get to do a lot of exciting discussions or do research in the community or go out to the community to serve the people that need services.
So you mentioned inequity earlier. This is certainly reflected, I'm sure, and as a matter of fact, your report does cite this, that minority groups and people of a lower socioeconomic standing are even less involved than others.
That's right. So when we think about sort of what's going on in high school civics or social studies class and then look at the young adults' engagement, we find that the people that have never gone to college, for example, have much lower levels of engagement, show less interest in politics, and are a lot less likely to think about running for offices.
You know, I would say that the elephant in the room probably is the politicians themselves. And again, citing your report, you point out that the politicians are setting pretty poor examples for the young people to want to become engaged.
That's right. When, you know, we ask young people what they think the politics is doing for them, right? The Harvard IOP poll found that, you know, about only a quarter of young people believe that getting involved has any tangible effect. And the rest of them were either unsure or did not believe that would happen ever. And that's really a problem in that, you know, this generation of young people have a lot of desire to help, a lot of desire to contribute to where they're from and to the people they care about. But they really can't seem to find an outlet that's satisfying enough in politics to be able to do that. They just don't think it's a system that's working.
Well, you're looking at young people aged 18 to 25. That is 18, obviously, being the voting age.
Yeah.
Is there any indication that you have found or were you able in your research to determine if attitudes change after the age of 25, when young people get married and start to raise families and start to own homes? Do they change?
That's a really interesting question. And again, it's a somewhat unique question for this generation. So in the past, people have become, you know, generally become a little bit more conservative, but they tend to actually maintain their partisan leaning overall. This generation, though, is actually moving into what's called adulthood a little bit later than our previous generation did, right? People aren't getting married until 30s instead of, you know, mid-20s. They're not even finishing school until mid-20s. So the sort of the definition of youth is changing a little bit. So it's hard to sort of decide whether they're going to actually change after a while or not. There's really not an indication, though, between now, between, you know, somebody that's 21 and 27, let's say, there are not a lot of differences right now.
So after this study, Kay, do you come out of it personally a little more optimistic, perhaps, than you went in, or are you discouraged?
You know, I think I come with sort of both recognition of challenges that are real and opportunities that are there. You know, we've studied this generation or young people for over 10 years as a group, and we've seen some changes in that population. But, you know, what we keep seeing is this incredible resource and assets this generation has in their desire to help and their creativity, their aptitude to tech, you know, use technology and learn new things. So those things are all there. I think that we as a society and multiple stakeholders, including politicians, media, schools, and families, all have the responsibilities to figure out a way to leverage that so that we have more kids like Gabe. I think we can do that, but we really need to have great policies that make sense together, that come together to really help teacher do a good job in teaching kids how to think about issues critically, discuss topics that are important to them, produce different kind of, you know, media, and get them excited. And the families need to be able to support that by encouraging them to express opinions or have them, you know, talk about politics at the dinner table. And the community need to support that as well.
Well, let's talk about some of the other recommendations that you have in your report. You have several. A couple of them are very interesting, one of which is to reduce the voting age, at least lower the voting age, for some elections.
Yes. So that actually happened very recently in Tacoma Park, Maryland, for the first time. It's a city election-only voting age, but they lowered it to 16 successfully. And the rationale behind that was that if the kids can hear about local election while they're in high school using their classes, they are likely to get more involved because those are the issues that are relevant. You know, local election deal with things like who's going to be their mayor or what's going to happen to their parks, what's going to happen to their after-school programs and things like that that actually matter to kids. And as a matter of fact, the 16 to 17-year-old in that town voted at a much higher rate than 18 to 29-year-old, according to the analysis that's come out. So, you know, of course, there's an excitement factor where high school students were excited that they were able to vote for the first time. But if they're asked, they come out to vote.
So you're suggesting in some cases, and it's already happened in Tacoma Park,
yep,
that kids can vote before they can drive.
That's true. Yeah,
I wonder which is more exciting to them.
You know, then I think my dream is that the voting is even more exciting than driving. But, you know, the research actually suggests that the 16-year-old is just as competent in political knowledge as 25-year-olds. So there's really not a knowledge or information issue there. It's just a matter of whether, you know, we can agree that 16 is mature enough to vote. And all information suggests that they are mature enough to vote.
If they are informed. I think Thomas Jefferson said the worst threat to democracy is an uninformed electorate.
Right. And that's sort of the, you know, the ongoing questions between people that really think that the young people should vote and those who that don't think the young people should vote because they tend to think the young people lack political knowledge. I think our belief is that, you know, we can do a better job in communicating information as much as possible through media and education. But, you know, every citizen has the right and obligation to vote.
Well, that is true. And the media role would be important. Sometimes, even though we here are a part of the media, we question the way we cover politics sometimes, make it a horse race, which maybe makes it more exciting for a young person, but doesn't provide much in the way of information.
That's right. You know, I think young people really do need to understand what's at stake when they talk about policies, not just sort of who's going to win. Because I think, you know, with President Obama's popularity going down somewhat, it's not like they're finding a different leader that they can trust. They're really in search of who they can trust, and they're not finding that right now in the political atmosphere. And in order for them to get motivated again, they have to be motivated by issues and things that actually matter to them. And in order to do that, they need to really understand what's at stake.
It's a fascinating report that you folks at Tufts have put together, Kay Kawashima Ginsburg, and we'll put put that report on our website at stlpublicradio.org so people can get the full benefit of all the hard work that you put into it. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
That's Kay Kawashima Ginsburg from Tufts University. Join Steve Potter tomorrow for Cityscape, and he'll talk about the Bach Society of St. Louis's Christmas Candlelight Concert, also with vocalist Brian Owens about his current work, including a holiday concert to benefit the UMSL Alumni Association Scholarship Fund, and about a holiday concert by musicians from several local bands to benefit Covenant House, Missouri. Monday on St. Louis on the Air, we'll take a look at current issues pertaining to the law with our Legal Roundtable panel. Archive versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis on the Air is produced by Mary Edwards and Alex Hoyer, with production assistance from Camille Phillips, Aaron Dorr, Jeremy Bailey, Kristen Torres, and Spencer Reed. The executive producer, Robert Peterson. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.